America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, 466 days, 12 hours, 47 minutes, 25 seconds, until George Bush voluntarily leaves office. And now with us, President Carter.
Yes.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning. This is Tom.
This is Tom Hartman.
All right. I understand I'm talking to you and folks all across the nation.
Yeah, it is a pleasure and an honor to speak with you again, sir, in your new book, Beyond the White House, Waging Peace, Fighting Disease, Building Hope. I found to be an extraordinarily inspiring read.
All right. I'm glad to hear you say that.
You have done such marvelous work from early on in the book where you talk about, for example, North Korea. I think it's meta to the entire book, how the North Koreans knew that you had a military background, nuclear reactor background, and yet you still got some pushback on this.
Well, when you tackle a really difficult subject like trying to stop the North Koreans from making nuclear weapons, that is inherently a difficult subject. But we were successful, as you know, and then Bill Clinton adopted what we did and put it into effect, but it was thrown in the wastebasket when the new administration came in, and unfortunately that led to enough plutonium being reprocessed to build 5 or 6 nuclear weapons. I hope now we'll see a final end to that drama.
Yeah. In fact, I'd like to come back to that theme in a minute, but I want to stay in the book for a moment. You talk about in your chapter, Waging Peace, how Kofi Annan welcomed your trip to Bosnia and the work that you were doing, and yet at the same time, Lawrence Eagleburger, who had been the Secretary of State under the first George Bush, attacked your efforts, as well as your visit to North Korea and Haiti. How have you been able to have such extraordinary success around the world in waging peace, to use your phrase, in the face of these attacks from the right-wing extreme elements in the United States?
Well, quite often, no matter who they are, they have an inclination to think that military action or the threat of an attack is more effective than quiet diplomacy, where you actually share common goals with those that are causing a problem. And the Carter Center has refrained from going into those really sensitive areas unless we got the at least tacit approval from the White House. But once we get there, we try to use the basic principles of mediation, negotiation, diplomacy, and appeal to the highest nature of those that are causing a problem. Also, a lot of people don't even want you to talk to someone who disagrees with you. And that's been the policy, unfortunately, of in Washington recently. If unless you agree with me completely in advance, I won't even talk to you or have diplomatic relations with you. I think that means that other people build up a sense of fear, and they prepare to lash back at you, and otherwise we could alleviate the problem.
Yeah, this is not a policy that has been followed by the United States, ranging from the treaty with Tripoli in the late 1700s up until certainly your presidentship, and I would say every president until George W. Bush, unless, please correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, I think that's correct. There's been some radical departures in recent years from what all previous presidents have done, including Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr. and Richard Nixon, as well as Democratic presidents. In the field of environmental equality, in the field of human rights, and also in the field of peace, because we've always had a policy in the past until the last few years of going to war only if our national security was in danger. Now we have a new policy publicly announced by the president at West Point that we're going to have preemptive war. We're going to go to war even when our own security is not endangered. And some of the right-wing people, to whom you referred to earlier, think that's a very good policy, is to go to war or to threaten war as a way to accomplish our goals. Quite often that's not the right way.
Yeah, I had Norman Podhertz on our program here, debated him some weeks ago. He would serve in Giuliani's administration. He's written a book about attacking Iran, and it's really all he wanted to talk about. It seems to be the absolute drumbeat. Now, what are your thoughts on the folks within the administration and the advisors to many of the Republican candidates who are so aggressive about attacking Iran rather than pursuing the policy that you have been so successful in pursuing since your departure from the presidency and starting the Carter Center in waging peace?
Well, I've noticed on the news, at least I haven't watched the debates, that Giuliani, for instance, and others are publicly advocating you know, the expansion of Guantanamo as a prison camp, and also the attack on Iran as the best way to resolve the Iranian issue. To invade or to bomb or to later to try to invade Iran would be a much more horrible catastrophe even than Iraq has been. And the best approach, in my opinion, to a troubled country like Iran is to have diplomatic relations with them, at least exchange ideas with them, use the maximum extent of the benefits of diplomacy, which have worked over the last 1,000 years in international affairs, and then also not continue to threaten them with a preemptive strike. If they think always through the public statements of the administration that we are about to launch a bombing raid on them, it makes them much more inclined to resort to militancy on their part than if they knew we were trying to deal with it diplomatically.
Yeah. My recollection is that several presidents, John Quincy Adams, Mr. Madison, James Madison, both went back into the legislature after leaving the presidency. They maintained political activity. You are certainly not doing that, but you're not afraid to speak out about your thoughts on the way the country is going, and the conservatives are attacking you mercilessly about this, that as if former presidents don't have a right to speak. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I've expressed the thoughts, as you have so wisely said in this book, Beyond the White House, which shows that there are a multiplicity of challenges and opportunities around the world that can be pursued either by government agencies like the U.S. government or the United Nations, or by private organizations or by individuals. And they are exciting and challenging and unpredictable adventures that really bring great gratification to anyone involved and also bring relief of suffering from others. And in the pursuance of peace and democracy, freedom, for instance, we have held or monitored 68 elections so far, all in troubled countries. And so what I try to describe in this book is how there is an alternative to war. There's an alternative to freezing people out. There's an alternative to ignoring the suffering of others. So it's a kind of an exciting adventure to me, not just a despondent acquiescence to international affairs.
President Carter, in your book Beyond the White House, Waging Peace, Fighting Disease, Building Hope, an absolutely brilliant and fascinating, compelling read. You talk in your Fighting Disease chapter about the importance of the subtleties of culture and understanding them, particularly in I was particularly touched by the chapter on the guinea worms and,
yeah,
and dealing with these people about their water hole. Speak briefly about that story and how does that apply to larger issues like waging peace as well as waging health?
Well, we basically fill vacuums in the world, the Carter Center does. So we've gotten involved in 5 diseases that afflict hundreds of millions of people in Africa and other places that are no longer known in the rich world in which we live. And they are officially designated by the World Health Organization as neglected diseases. One of them, to which you refer, is guinea worm. We decided to take on the task the Carter Center did of eradicating this horrible, almost indescribable disease where long worms grow inside the human body and then emerge and cause horrible sores and pain and so forth. And we found this disease in 23,600 villages. We've been in all those villages now to teach people how to do about it in 20 countries in Asia and across the continent of Africa. And we found 3.6 million cases of guinea worm. We've now reduced those cases by 99.8%. And we just have 0.2% of the cases left. We know where every case is. And within the next few years, we'll eradicate this disease from the face of the earth. But it's been a very exciting adventure, and it shows what can be done, even in an intransigent case that's been there for tens of thousands of years, if you give people in those troubled communities just an opportunity to help themselves.
Finally, sir, in your book, Beyond the White House, Waging Peace, Fighting Disease, Building Hope, we're talking with President Jimmy Carter, an extraordinary message of peace and hope, frankly. What would your message be to Americans who seem in massive numbers to be apathetic about what's going on politically? What would you encourage people to do to wage peace here in the United States?
Well, you know, what I'd like to do is to see the next president of the United States in January 2009 take the oath of office and declare to the world that the American people will be represented by me, and I will no longer torture prisoners. I will no longer resort to preemptive war. I'll only attack another country if our own security is directly threatened. I'll be the leading advocate of protecting the international environment. I will be raising high the banner of basic human rights. Those are the kinds of commitments, I believe, that would represent accurately what the average American citizen feels and what I hope the next president will exemplify as a new one takes office.
President Jimmy Carter, you are one of the great statesmen of history, in my opinion, the Dag Hammarskjöld of this era. And your book, Beyond the White House, Waging Peace, Fighting Disease, Building Hope, I hope everybody picks up a copy and reads. It's marvelous. Thank you so much, sir, for the honor.
Thank you, Tom. I really enjoyed being with you and all your listeners.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
17 minutes past the hour.
What you do and not what you say. If you're not part of the future, then get out of the way. Come on, baby, take a ride with me. I'm in the air, I got a tendency. Everything is cool as can be as we
the world. Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. This is the week. This week is the anniversary. Actually, today is the anniversary, as I recall, of Bush signing. I have to find my timeline here. What is today's date? It's the 11th. Yeah, today is the anniversary of the vote in the Senate, 77-23 in favor of Senate Resolution 46, which authorized George Bush, if he wrote a letter to Congress within 48 hours of commencing hostilities, to say, saying something very specific, which we'll get to in a second, but this is the anniversary of the authorization, what is referred to as the authorization for war in Iraq. Now, here's the actual language from the authorization. It says, in connection with the exercise of the authority granted in subsection A to use force, the president shall, prior to such exercise or as soon thereafter as may be feasible, but no later than 48 hours after exercising such authority, make available to the Speaker of House of the House of Representatives and the President Pro Tem of the Senate his determination that, one, reliance by the United States on further diplomatic or other peaceful means alone, either A, will not adequately protect the national security of the United States against the continuing threat posed by Iraq, or B, is not likely to lead to enforcement of the relevant UN Security Council resolutions regarding Iraq, and, two, acting pursuant to this joint resolution is consistent with the United States and other countries continuing to take the necessary actions against international terrorists and terrorist organizations, including those nations, organizations, or persons who planned, authorized, or committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001. In other words, that authorization, that so-called war authorization, said the only way Bush could go to war is if he certified to Congress that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. And sure enough, on March 18, 2003, you can find the letter over at whitehouse.gov. It's right there. George W. Bush, sincerely George W. Bush is how it's signed, wrote a letter to the Speaker. Dear Mr. Speaker, consistent with Section 3B of the Authorization for Use for Military Force Against Iraq Resolution of 2002, acting pursuant to the Constitution and Public Law 107-243, and then I would say this attack against Iraq, is consistent with the United States and other countries continuing to take the necessary actions against international terrorists and terrorist organizations, including those nations, organizations, or persons who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001. End of quote from George Bush's letter to Congress on March 18, 2003, right after the bombing began. In other words, he said, yes, we are going after Iraq because they had something to do with 9/11. Jimmy Carter had some thoughts on that that he shared with the British Broadcasting Corporation.
Dick Cheney is wrong. He's a militant who avoided any service of his own in the military. And he has been most forceful in the last 10 years or more in fulfilling some of his more ancient commitments that the United States has a right to inject its power through military means in other parts of the world. And here he's trying again
to promote what might very well be a counterproductive and a catastrophic military adventure.
This the possible war with Iran. Carter continues.
Well, you know, he's been a disaster for our country. I think he's been overly persuasive on President George Bush, and quite often he's prevailed. But it was one of his main commitments was to go into Iraq under false pretenses, and he still maintains that those false pretenses are accurate. He still thinks Saddam Hussein was involved in the 9/11 attacks.
Well, he has to, because that's what George W. Bush said in the letter, and if it turns out that that letter was a lie, then Bush could be impeached for it. Carter also talking about their bad batting average.
Like President Cheney has said for the last 3 or 4 years concerning Iraq, his batting average is abysmally low. He hasn't been right on hardly anything. And his prediction of what was going to happen, reasons for going over there. And obviously, you know, this is not playing into the hands of Al-Qaeda or the people who are causing violence and destruction over there to call for a change in policy in Iraq.
So here's the question. What should we do? What should we do? Should the case where Bill Clinton was sued by a private citizen, I believe it was Jennifer Flowers, while he was a sitting president, was allowed by the Supreme Court. If my recollection is correct, there is a precedent for private citizens suing a sitting president. If my memory is correct, should we pursue that? Should we be pushing for impeachment? Should we be asking the International Criminal Tribunal for war crimes charges against these folks? What should we do? Or shall we simply work as hard as we can to get people into office who will end this horrible national nightmare? 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Please celebrate mediocrity. All the boys upstairs want to see how much you'll pay for what you used to get for free. There goes the last DJ, who plays what he wants to play, and says what he wants to say, hey, hey, hey. And there goes your...
Today, the anniversary, 5 years ago, in 2002, of the Senate voting 22 Democrats and one independent. That would be Bernie Sanders opposing the resolution. Today is the anniversary of the vote in the Senate authorizing George Bush to go to war with Iraq if he certifies that Iraq participated in or had some connection to or aided or abetted the attacks against the United States on 9/11, which he did. And it just blows my mind that this little caveat is missing from all of the coverage. I'm going to take your calls on this and on Jimmy Carter in just a second, but just step into the Wayback Machine here. Robert Byrd on the floor of the Senate, just before this vote was taken, speaking about the insanity of this vote.
The idea that the United States or any other nation can legitimately attack a nation that is not imminently threatening, but which may be threatening in the future. The idea that the United States may attack a sovereign government because of a dislike for a particular regime is a radical new twist on the traditional idea of self-defense.
And not just radical for the United States. I mean, this is a violation of international treaties and laws.
This administration has turned the patient art of diplomacy on its head, turned the patient art of diplomacy into threats, labeling and name-calling of the sort that reflects quite poorly on the intelligence and sensitivity of our leaders and which will have consequences for years to come.
And then he refers to Bush calling Kim Jong-il a pygmy and continues talking about how silent this chamber is, the Senate, in opposition to this war.
Calling heads of states pygmies? labeling whole countries as evil, denigrating powerful European allies as irrelevant. In only the space of 2 short years, this reckless and arrogant administration has initiated policies which may reap disastrous consequences for years.
And they have. This, keep in mind, was a speech that Robert Byrd gave on the floor of the Senate on this day in 2002.
Will we seize Iraq's oil fields?
Yep.
Becoming an occupying power?
Yep.
Which controls the price and supply of that nation's oil for the foreseeable future?
Yep.
There are some who think so. Frankly, many of the pronouncements made by this administration are outrageous. There's no other word. And yet this chamber is hauntingly silent. Silent.
And they were. And they were. And a number of those who voted for the resolution are now running for president. The Republicans all gung-ho. It was a fine thing we did. At least the Democrats have had the good graces to apologize in most cases for their vote and admit that it was wrong. Nobody, however, has taken the next step, which it seems to me such an obvious step, and certainly would have been the case if this had been a Democratic president, of saying when the president wrote the letter to Congress in compliance with this authorization, he lied about the connection of Saddam Hussein to 9/11. He lied. Joe in San Diego, California, listening on KLSD. Hey, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
I am just great. And by the way, talking with the folks, management over at KLSD yesterday, nobody's sure about the future of the station, but there's a great search on in the event the station changes to keep progressive radio on in San Diego. So I think that there's going to be some good news down the road.
Well, that's very gratifying. The reason I'm calling is reading that the resolution that you read. It's very chilling for a couple of reasons. First of all, it doesn't speak specifically to Iraq. It speaks to any nation, to the right to attack any nation that aided and abetted the attacks of 9/11. And every once in a while I go online and I read the right-wing press, National Review, Weekly Standard, just to see what they're saying. And for one thing, it's really fascinating how quiet and silent they are about Iraq these days. But there was an essay that I can't give you the name of the author that I read yesterday, where he was developing the same links to Iran that were developed supposedly with regard to Iraq and 9/11.
Well, that's what Norman Podhertz did on this program a couple of weeks ago. And he, the guy who is now a senior advisor to the Giuliani campaign. Giuliani is surrounding himself with these neocons, these warmongers, because basically that's the only thing he's got to run on for the Republican base, because the Republican base hates him on everything else. And it's driving the entire Republican Party farther and farther, not that he had to drive him very far anyway, but farther and farther into the camp of absolute insanity, war insanity. It's frothing at the mouth, war insanity.
What concerns me is that it in some ways it's driving the Democrats too, because I can just see the scenario of probably in August or September of next year, there will be an attack on Iran. And whether it's Hillary, who's a Democratic candidate, or someone else, if they raise any questions about it, they're signing on to these recent resolutions about Iran will be thrown up in their face. And if it's someone like Edwards, who's been at the center, they'll just be branded as a wimp and a appeaser.
And you're thinking August, September. I'm thinking October for maximum impact in the elections. But time will tell. You know, God forbid that either one of us is true. Hopefully we're both wrong, but... Joe, thanks for the call and thanks for the point. Thanks for listening to KLSD. There'll be a rally, by the way, on Friday at the offices of KLSD for those of you who are listening in San Diego down at the Clear Channel offices, where I was broadcasting from, in fact, a week or so ago. Great folks. Dave in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. I've always admired Jimmy Carter, even amongst a lot of naysayers. What a great human being and so awe-inspiring just to listen to.
I think he was one of our greatest presidents.
I do, too, and a lot of people fail to see that, and I have never wavered from that idea. I grew up admiring him, and I can only imagine what it must be like for young people today looking at the president that we have. How do you admire that? The question you brought up, we can have we the people again. Did I hear you say at the end of the last segment that impeachment can be we the people?
No, I'm just curious. Paula Jones, I believe, was able to sue Bill Clinton, and that then led to the whole inquiry, which led to ultimately discovery of Monica, which led to the impeachment of Bill Clinton. And I was just wondering out loud if it's probably a question to put to a constitutional scholar, whether there is some action that we the people could take. My guess is if there is, probably somebody would have done it.
Well,
I know that Ellen Ratner's brother has been trying to get Rumsfeld and company indicted over in Germany, but without any success. But.
Yeah, I've gone through the New York State Attorney General, and I filed through the RICO statute, but it turned out that it couldn't go through. They had to get special permission, and it was declined. But I tried to go through the back door. I didn't think the Attorney General would do it, so I thought maybe New York State would do it. But
RICO is fairly narrowly defined, and it doesn't include political crimes. There's a very narrow category of things that RICO can be applied to. Although I agree with you that the Republican Party and the Bush administration in particular, but the Republican Party in general, is being run now as a criminal organization, as a absolutely parallel to the mafia. I mean, right down to the old Meritan, or whatever, however you say it, the doctrine of silence and support and everything else.
And that's how I was viewing it, and that was my attempt. I wanted to at least try, and if anyone needs my help, I'm certainly standing up to the plate. If impeachment is the way to go and if we need to do it, I'm kicking the door down.
Good on you, Dave. Keep at it. Andy in Seattle. Hey, Andy, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Tom.
Sure.
You know, Jimmy Carter is just an amazing soul, and it's great to hear him, and I'm glad to have the intelligent discourse on your show. It's great. Incredibly inspiring, isn't he?
He is. He's a truly brilliant man and a role model, frankly, for our young people and for anybody in political life. Here's a guy who's devoted his life after leaving the presidency to bringing peace to the world, and the Carter Center doing some great work, as opposed to George W. Bush, who wants to spend $500 million on a library full of scholars to basically rewrite history. Tom in Westchester, Pennsylvania, we have about a half a minute here before we got to take a break. Tom, what's up?
Well, thanks for taking my call. I saw a news clip one time. A reporter asked George Bush what Iraq had to do with 9/11, and George Bush said Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11.
That's right. He said that on several occasions, as a matter of fact. I have several clips of it floating around here.
Right. Well, if he said that, and then his letter that he wrote says that they had something to do with it, how come we aren't impeaching him for lying?
That's the question that I'm asking. I'm saying his letter to Congress is prima facie evidence that although, they may make the argument that back then they had bad intelligence, George Tenet lied to him or something like that. But basically, on the bottom line, here you have caught in a lie. That, the Downing Street minutes, the discussions in, as I recall, Spain. I mean, there's been a whole series of stories coming out about how this administration was determined to go to war no matter what. And they did it based on false pretenses. They lied to us for an aggressive war.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
I'm Main Street, whitewashed windows, vacant stores. Seems like there ain't nobody wants to come down here no more. They're closing down textile mills across the railroad tracks. Mormon says these jobs are going, boys, and they ain't coming back to your hometown.
Those jobs ain't coming back unless we elect some good progressive populist Democrats to office. Maybe even some good progressive Republicans. There actually used to be such a thing. Teddy Roosevelt is probably the most famous of them. Anyhow, strange stuff going on out there in the world. In And Bogota, Colombia, a hit game show, Nothing But the Truth, was canceled. After a contestant won $25,000, she told the ultimate truth. She'd hire someone to kill her husband. Yeah. But wait, there's more. A U.S. version called Moment of Truth is still expected to be launched on Fox in the coming months. But wait, there's more. In the Colombian version, dollar desperate contestants confessed everything from drug smuggling to gay prostitution before a studio audience packed with unsuspecting loved ones. And now Fox wants to bring this to us here in the United States. Yes, somehow it just seems unsurprising. John in Seattle. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hey, this is Giancarlo.
Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, perfect. Hey, I did want to kind of bring this Iran thing up. It seems that more and more we see this in the granted. I mean, kind of what's happened, it seems that Iraq has now been replaced with Iran. Just in case anybody doubts that Iran actually has nuclear weapons or has, you know, it presents some kind of threat to us, look, check out the Los Angeles Times article dated July 15th. It was leaked from the military that 45% of the insurgency is from Saudi Arabia, not Iran.
That's right.
Right. If you want to also believe the official conspiracy theory about 9/11, okay, 14 of the hijackers came from Saudi Arabia. Osama bin Laden is from Saudi Arabia. And what do we do to these people? We reward them with a $20 billion weapons contract in the next, I believe, 8 years to Saudi Arabia. Okay, if you want to attack a country, why don't we go to Pakistan, where supposedly Osama bin Laden is somewhere in the mountains, okay? Iran is complying with the IAEA, okay? They signed the NPT treaty, whereas Israel has not. India has not, Pakistan has not, and we know that they all have, pretty much have nuclear weapons. I think that, you know, basically mainstream news needs to know that there's people like myself and others out there that know the truth, that read this stuff, and people just need to stop believing this crap. Turn off the TV, read, you know, just start reading and know the truth for yourself.
Well said, John. Or let's lobby the TV to start actually telling the truthful news, because you're absolutely right on all on all points. And of course, we reported this when the LA Times reported it, that about half of all the insurgents, of foreign insurgents who have been captured in Iraq, are Saudis. And a very, very, very tiny percentage, a very tiny percentage, have been people from Iran. Dave in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Dave.
Hello, Tom. I'd like to support your comment about Carter. Carter was absolutely a great president, and he his ideas were spot on, certainly about the dependence on foreign oil. And also, I'd like to point out the laughable hypocrisy when Jimmy Carter is mentioned, if you're talking to righties, how they'll bring up his double-digit in inflation and in interest rates. Yet when we talk about Clinton's great economy, they'll say, well, that was because of the Republican predecessor, the administrations before Clinton. Why doesn't Carter get the same courtesy it's laughable.
Well, because courtesy is not in the vernacular of most conservative commentators. Your point is well taken, though, Dave, and I've said it many times, that Carter's inflation was the consequence of Nixon and LBJ, for that matter, but Nixon in a big way, having paid for the Vietnam War on credit, and then the bill came due, just like right now Bush is paying for the Iraq occupation on credit, and the bill will come due in the next 10 to 15 years. Robin in Pinckney, Michigan. Hey, Robin.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to go back on your previous questions to listeners about what can be done about this criminal enterprise we have inheriting the White House or inhabiting the White House. And the reason Paula Jones was able to sue Clinton was because the courts made an exception on the basis of an incident that happened before Clinton took office. And that's why it's very difficult. It's almost impossible to sue a sitting president for action.
But we have George Bush in 1999 telling his biographer, Mickey Herskowitz, that if he was elected president, he would attack Iraq for political purposes to gain political power so he could roll back the New Deal. So could that be used as the basis for a lawsuit?
No, because what he says is different than what he does. You'd have to sue him on the basis of what he... I mean, you can't really...
On the basis of behavior,
on the basis
words.
Of his current behavior. So what the only thing I could think of to maybe crack that would be to sue him for violating his oath of office. but how you'd get standing to do that and what a person could allege as damages would be the difficult issues, and even whether a court would allow something like that to
go through. Well, the remedy is provided for in the Constitution.
Yeah,
it's mentioned six
impeachment.
Times. It's called impeachment, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's the bottom line. Robin,
also,
I'm sorry, Robin. The button was already gone. I appreciate the call, and thanks for educating on this. Dan in Louisville, Kentucky. You got about a minute here, Dan.
Hi, Tom. That's fine. I just wanted to thank you very much for having Jimmy Carter. You know, even a crappy phone line interview with him would be better than an in-studio interview with some of the people that are running today. It made me nostalgic for a time when we could elect somebody who could win the Nobel Peace Prize while in office, who could work for us Americans regardless of the recriminations on himself. He always did the right thing. I cried in 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected.
Yeah,
and
a lot
I thank
horrified.
You so much for letting us hear him again.
You're welcome, Dan. In fact, it's the third time Jimmy Carter's been on this program. And I think that we need to remember also that America, by and large, thought that Ronald Reagan was a crackpot. And if those hostages had not been held in Iran, Carter was way ahead in the votes right up until the last few months or right up until the last few weeks. Carter would have been elected over Ronald Reagan. Coming up next, should vets have guns taken away from them, or is this just a red herring? Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
And welcome back. Our quote for the day from Jimmy Carter: the best way to enhance freedom in other lands is to demonstrate here that our democratic system is worthy of emulation. Our quote for the day. Welcome back to the program. Eric Pratt is with us. He's with Gun Owners of America. Gunowners.org is the website, the communications director. By coincidence, I yesterday got my NRA membership renewal card, a little black plastic stick-in-your-wallet card in the mail. And, Eric, the NRA is gung-ho in favor of House Resolution 2640, which is an amendment to the Brady Bill. And you are out there calling this the Veterans Disarmament Act, which is not the actual name of the legislation. And you're quite upset about it. Why two different gun organizations taking these radically different positions on the same piece of legislation?
Well, Gun Owners of America, first of all, opposed the Brady Bill. NRA supported it. So from the very beginning, even though we're trying to defend the Second Amendment, we sometimes take radically different approaches. This bill, which we're talking about, will disqualify military veterans, some who've had the shakes, some who are suffering from nightmares. Is going to prevent them from owning guns. And that's why the Military Order of the Purple Heart has joined us in opposing this. The American Legion has joined us in opposing this. And I should also mention, in opposing this, we're in opposition to the likes of Chuck Schumer and Carolyn McCarthy, two of the most notorious gun grabbers in the Congress that are pushing this.
And the National Rifle Association.
Well, they have joined
us. This is something I don't get. You say, you know, somebody's got the shakes, they're not going to be able to buy a gun because they're a veteran and they've got the shakes. But I've actually read the legislation, H.R. 2640. I've got a copy of it here. And it says that anyone who has been adjudicated as a mental defective or who has been committed to any mental institution, that's their criterion, may not get a gun permit, right? They go into the Federal Register of people who can't buy guns. Let me just finish. The government's definition of a mental defective is, quote, a determination by a court, board, commission, or other lawful authority that a person, as a result of marked subnormal intelligence or mental illness, incompetency, condition, or disease, one, is a danger to himself or others, and two, lacks the mental capacity to contract or manage his own affairs. The term shall include a finding of insanity by a court in a criminal case, end of quote. In other words, shakes isn't enough. You've got to have somebody who has been involuntarily committed. Not even a voluntary commitment is enough. You have to have somebody who has been found, adjudicated, who has been involuntarily committed for being basically, I don't want to say crazy or nuts throw the term around
way.
Hey,
Tom, can I end your filibuster? Not true. You're not reading the legislation carefully enough, because what you were saying was true in 1968. this legislation changes the definitions of exactly what you just talked about, because it's not just an adjudication anymore. It is now a determination. It can be a determination by a shrink, and all they have to find, if you had continued reading, you would have seen that a...
That's what I quoted to you. A mental defective is a determination by a court, board, or commission.
Tom, I am quoting from Section 101, C1C of the legislation, that a finding that a person is a danger to himself or to others will be enough to get you disqualified. That's exactly what happened.
Right. It requires a finding by an official agency.
Tom, did you really want me on here, or do you just want a monologue? Okay, that is exactly what is happening to veterans that are hit with PTSD. That is exactly why the Clinton administration already illegitimately denied them 10 years ago.
Not true, Eric. A finding of PTSD is not a finding that a person is mentally defective.
Tom, this has already been done, and you're on the side of Chuck Schumer, and I'm on the side of the...
I'm on the side of the National Rifle Association.
The American Legion is opposed to them, and so is the military order, the Purple Heart. Yes, you are on the side of the people that supported the 1934 Gun Control Act, the 1968 Gun Control Act, the Brady Bill as well. So, yeah, you can be on their side, Tom. This is just more gun control. People want to read more about this, go to gunowners.org, gunowners with an S. We have a whole section on this. Tom, you're selectively quoting parts of the bill, parts of the law. What you don't realize, you've just bought this hook, line, and sinker. You don't realize that the definitions are being changed here. It's no longer going to be an adjudication in a court, solely an adjudication in a court. Now it can be a shrink's determination. And that's exactly...
It doesn't say that. I'm reading from it. It says a determination by a court, board, commission, or other lawful authority.
Tom, even the NRA agrees that President Clinton did this. So for you to say that they didn't, you just don't know your...
We're not talking about President Clinton. We're talking about this. We're talking about this piece of legislation.
See, this is exactly the point. Clinton already did that to people with PTSD. See, this is already... He did it legitimately. This bill is now...
This bill would prevent that. This bill would prevent that. This bill requires a determination by a, quote, court, board, commission, or other lawful authority.
Tom, go to Section 101, C1C. The adjudication, determination, or commitment. Okay?
See, right. Somebody who is involuntarily committed by others. Somebody who voluntarily commits themselves, or somebody who merely has a diagnosis of PTSD, would not be eligible to be on this database and therefore would be able to carry a concealed weapon.
Tom,
and you know it.
Already people have been denied because of a shrink's determination. And now this legislation...
If that shrink's determination led to their being involuntarily committed to a mental hospital, do you really want, Eric, people...
Committed.
Do you really want people who have been determined to be dangerous to themselves and to others by a psychological or psychiatric professional to carry a concealed weapon? You want that kind of a society?
Tom, a kid in Minnesota recently. Okay, he says, he writes an email to the school vice principal and says, you know, if somebody at that school in Virginia Tech had had a gun, that tragedy wouldn't have occurred. Okay, he's now been referred to a mental psychiatrist, actually mandated. He cannot come back to school unless he is examined by a shrink.
But this nonetheless, he could still get a permit to carry a concealed weapon even after this legislation
says, you know what? You know, not if that shrink says, you know what, for you saying stuff like that, you really are crazy. You really are a danger to some, to others. That's a...
And involuntarily commits him. That's a huge if.
Tom, stop.
Eric,
Tom,
you're building this all around ifs.
Tom, you're cutting me off again. That's already happened in Pennsylvania, by the way. Go and look at our alerts. A guy in Pennsylvania said that exact same thing on a school campus. He was involuntarily committed for it. He can no longer own a gun. He's already had his guns taken away. Tom, this is where we're going. You're closing... You have a blind eye to this because you're just swallowing what is being fed to you. I challenge you to read this bill carefully and read our analysis, our lawyerly analysis on the web.
So let me ask
you
a question. Just a very straightforward question here. Eric Pratt with gunowners.org, Gun Owners of America. Who in our society do you think should be prevented from carrying a concealed weapon?
That's the wrong question, Tom. Bad guys are...
I don't care if it's a right or wrong question. It's the question I'm asking you.
No.
Who in our society should be prevented from carrying a concealed weapon?
Where have restrictions ever worked to stop people from carrying guns? See, you've got the mindset...
So your answer is nobody.
That is not the government's job.
You think Charlie Manson, if he gets out of prison, should be able to carry it? Here's a simple question, Eric Pratt. If Charlie Manson, Eric, calm down for a minute. Listen, you've interrupted me just as much as I've interrupted you.
Tom,
if Charlie Manson gets out of prison, I'm asking you a question, Eric. If Charlie Manson gets out of prison, and do you think he should be allowed to carry a concealed weapon?
I'm answering it, Tom. Your solution does not work. That's the solution of England. It does not work. They have higher crime rate than we do.
So if Charlie Manson gets out of prison...
See, you are cutting me off again. That is the solution.
You haven't answered my question!
I'm answering your question. Canada has strict gun control, much more than we do. They still have school shootings. It hasn't worked, Tom. Tell me, where has it? Washington, D.C., Chicago, Los Angeles? Where has your approach restricting firearms, controlling who can get guns, where has it worked? Tell me, just one. Tell me.
Canada has a fragment of the murders on a per capita basis that we do in the United States by firearms. I'm surprised you'd bring that up.
Where? England?
Canada. You just said Canada.
Tom, they still have school shootings. That's my point. They still have school shootings. And England, by the way, which has almost banned guns completely. Now, don't cut me off yet, Tom. England now has a crime rate much higher than us. And just go read the UN reports. It's according to the United Nations, England has a higher crime rate than does America or all the other 17 industrialized nations in this world. The mayor of London has said he feels safer in New York City than he does in London. What does that tell you? Their gun ban has not worked. Their approach trying to stop bad guys from getting guns has not work. They are a more dangerous society than we are.
So Charlie Manson should be able to get a permit if he gets out of jail.
You're not going to stop him from getting a gun. That's my point. See, why are you trying to...
So you might as well just give him a permit.
Why are you acting like the nanny government, Tom? You're not going to stop people from getting guns.
Because I think that if somebody has been institutionalized, they should not have a permit to carry a concealed weapon.
And so that's what leads us to banning.
I'm starting to wonder about you, Eric. It's getting a little scary here. All righty. Well, our listeners can make up their own minds. I have a lot of trust in their intellect. Gunowners.org is your website. There's also a piece about this over at VAWatchdog.org. Eric Pratt, thanks a lot for being with us, Eric.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
16 minutes. Right?
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
And is she in better run? Better watch her liberal buns. Tell them that the war's not through. It probably put a hole in you.
Cheney's got his gun! If we're going to start gun control, maybe that's where we should start it with. In fact, absolutely, that's where we should start it with.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The liberal shadow knows.
Yes. Yes, I do. And the evil lurking in the hearts of this particular guy, this is Mitch McConnell, the Republican from Kentucky, the Senate Minority Leader. It looks like he's the guy, or at least his communications director, Don Stewart, behind the right-wing smear on a 12-year-old kid. This right-wing hit job on a 12-year-old kid. This is absolutely incredible. Mitch McConnell, United States Senator, I don't know. I'm going to have to come up with a word for it. The words that immediately come to mind are things I can't say on the air. Of the week. Anyhow. So, what do we do? Should there be a registry of people who are convicted criminals and particularly gun criminals and people who are severely mentally disturbed in ways that have been adjudicated by a court and have been institutionalized for violence so that they can't buy a gun? Or should we simply say to them, yeah, go at it, no problem? So, good question. Dan in San Diego, listening on KLSD. What are your thoughts, Dan?
Yeah, the mindset of some of the pro-gun people, really boggles my mind. They You know, the same people who say the world would be more dangerous if more countries had nukes, they're the same people who are saying the streets would be safer if everybody was packing a gun. I mean, you know, it's like they kind of contradict themselves, you know?
Yeah, no doubt about it. And good point. Frank in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Frank. Or, I'm sorry, Tim in Los Angeles. Hey, Tim.
Hey, what's up, Tom? I'm a gun owner, but I agree with you, you know, to a degree, and I also agree with Eric, too, because I don't want a government to say that I'm crazy because I disagree with them, so they take away my rifles. And as for, you know, the
PTSD. But this law says, it doesn't say that if you have PTSD, they take away your gun. It doesn't say that at all. It says
right.
You have been institutionalized involuntarily. I mean, if you have PTSD and you voluntarily check yourself into an institution, no problem. You can still get a concealed weapon permit. If you are involuntarily committed and determined to be a threat, then you can't have a gun. Sorry.
Exactly. So, I mean, I got no problem with that, but what's stopping, say, like the Bush administration or any administration in the future from saying, oh, Tim is crazy, well, so let's put him inside, let's lock him up, let's take away...
What's stopping him from doing that are millions of NRA members and millions of rational people all across the United States. It's just, you know, not going to happen. I mean, do you really think that anybody and everybody in the United States should have the right to carry a permit or should get a permit to carry a concealed weapon or should be able to carry one without a permit?
I mean, I don't have one because they don't have one in California, but what I'm worried about is like the police state actually forming, creating, and actually going through with it.
Yeah. No, I understand that, Tim, and a lot of people say, we got to worry about the police state because they're going to take away our guns, and then we can't revolt against them. Well, the fact of the matter is, even with any kind of gun that you can legally own right now, you still couldn't revolt against the government. You try taking on a Black Hawk helicopter with a hunting rifle. It ain't going to happen. It just ain't going to happen. Paul in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Paul.
Hey, hi, Tom. Love your show. What irritates me the most about all this discussion around gun control, more gun control, less gun control, permit, no permit, registry, is that I wish we would focus more on putting a lot more money into the mental health system so that we could treat people with mental health issues so that maybe we wouldn't have these kind of shootings.
Yeah, good point. Ronald Reagan was the one who eviscerated that program back in the early 80s, which led to all these people being deinstitutionalized and showing up on the streets. Before Reagan, we didn't have homelessness in the United States, except for back during the Great Depression, and it was a very different kind of homelessness. And now as a consequence of his cutting back. Yeah, absolutely. Paul, thanks a lot for your point. Frank in Denver. Hey, Frank.
Hi. Basically the same thing, Tom. What I was basically... concerned about here is just how rabid Eric got, and you were throwing out some facts that he didn't listen to at all, and which is basically the position I find just about any Republican in this situation with Bush. You try and bring out facts, and these people just get totally rabid with no nothing to back.
Maybe what I should have done is just pull out my .357 and just take that. I don't know. He probably wouldn't have liked it. Frank, thanks a lot for the call. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Stick around. We'll stick. There's more news, and we'll be continuing to take your calls on this and other topics. 866-303-2270. TomHartman.com, our live chat room. AirAmerica.com for our blog.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
He drank his first strong liquor then to calm his shaking hand and tried to tell himself at last he had become a man. A dusty cowpoke at his side began to laugh him down. And he heard again his mother's words, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town."
Yeah, and the good news here is that my cat Higgins can't get his paw into the trigger guard of my gun. Oh, who's that opening the door? It's Higgins! Hi! Whoa! Higgins! I Off he goes. 1-866-303-2270. Who should not have the right to own a gun in the United States? AJ in Brooklyn, New York, listening to WDRL. Hey, AJ.
Hi there. Greetings from the People's Republic of Brooklyn. I am a former police officer, and first of all, off topic for a moment, bless you for Jimmy Carter. Thank you so, so much.
You're welcome.
And
we should bless him for him, you know.
I offer you an analogy which you can use for free, and I'm surprised nobody's ever thought of it in these terms. Yeah, the genie, the old, when guns are banned, only the bad guys will have, will have guns. The genie's out of the bottle in that regard, okay? I can go down to Flatbush Avenue here in New York, and I can, a couple of Ben Franklins, I can walk back with a gun. That's bad. Bad guys do have guns. Now, I have several friends who have cancer, and that's a genie that's out of the bottle. A lot of people have cancer. Now, should we shut down Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center because that genie is out of the bottle? And, hey, people have cancer anyway, and, you know,
just because there's a problem doesn't mean we shouldn't try and do something about it.
Exactly. Exactly.
Good point, AJ. Good point.
Any step we can take is a good step.
Yeah. Okay. Very, very good point. Thank you very much. Roy, driving in California. Hey, Roy.
Hi, Tom. Great show. Three comments. One, I agree with your position about those people who should be on the registry and not allowed to have handguns. Two, it's general comment about gun control in general, about the Second Amendment. You know, there's a preparatory clause in that amendment that says a well-equipped militia being necessary, the people's right to own guns should not be abridged. I think people forget that. I think gun control is needed. And three, I think, if you will, check out the gun control laws in Spain. I know at least 25 years ago, when I was there in the military, private citizens could not own handguns, and their rate of incidence of violent crime is very low.
Yeah, that's true in Germany, and probably most European countries. I saw the same thing when I lived in Germany, and it just, you know, gun violence was pretty much non-existent. Good point, Roy. And in fact, if you go back and you look at the history of the Second Amendment, you discover that Thomas Jefferson, strong in particular, although there was a whole faction associated with him, strongly advocated that we should have a national service program. And he said, I hope we shall never see the day when our young men are willing to be shot at for a sixpence. He felt that everybody, from the age of every man anyway, from the age of 17 to 47, should be a member of a local militia. That once a month they should be trained in how to use their weapon, and they should keep a gun in their home, a rifle in their closet, and that when the church bells ring a particular way, they step out under the control of a local elected official, who is then subject to the authority of a regional elected official, who is then subject to the authority of the state governor, who is then ultimately subject to the authority of the president. So there's all these levels of control. And rationality, and that the Second Amendment in its first draft was a ban on a standing army during time of peace in the United States. Jefferson wanted that ban written into the Bill of Rights. Read his correspondence with Madison. When Madison in 1787, Jefferson was the U.S. envoy to France at the time, and Madison was writing the Constitution, Madison sends him the first draft of the Bill of Rights. And Jefferson says no, or the first draft of the Constitution rather, and Jefferson says no, we've got to have a Bill of Rights attached to us, and it has to say thus and so. And he lists everything that's in there right now, and one of the things that he says is there must be an absolute ban on standing armies during time of peace, because standing armies are one of the greatest threats to democracy. Governments are overthrown by their professional armies. So have every man in the nation be a member of the militia, and no standing army during time of peace, and the nation will be absolutely impossible to overthrow. And that's how Switzerland's been doing it for hundreds of years. Other countries do it like that around the world, and we chose not to. But that was the origin of the Second Amendment, and it was a compromise, ultimately. They stripped out the first sentence that said there shall be an absolute ban on standing armies by one vote. By one vote, they stripped that out, and so you ended up with this little fragment that was sort of like, you know, well, we'll kind of remember what's going on. Joel in Southampton, the United Kingdom. Hey, Joel, thanks for calling from England.
Hi, Tom. I just absolutely had to call. Me and my partner formerly lived in Eugene, Oregon, and we now live in Southampton, England, for the last couple of years. And I just have to say that the person that you interviewed that tried to say that the gun crime in England is worse than the United States is absolutely ridiculous. And I think it would be really important for you to look at the research on this. I listen to the BBC every night. We have strict gun controls here in the United Kingdom, and I think the last unfortunate killing that we had with a gun crime was about 3 weeks ago in Liverpool. Unfortunately, it was a young boy who was caught in the crossfire of some gangs. But we probably have less murder in the entire country of England than New York does in a whole year, and we have 60 million people, and probably the majority of those murders are knife murders. So
I noticed that Pratt was very careful not to say that England has more gun crime than the United States. He simply said England has more crime than the United States.
Well, and I probably,
given the population density of England versus how unpopulated and large chunks of the United States are, Vermont, Oklahoma, Montana, you know, where crime rates are relatively low, that may be true statistically.
Well, I don't know about that. If you're looking at pet crime, it might be equivalent or slightly above. But when you look at overall crime, I mean, it's just simply not the case. And specifically with regard to gun crimes or gun murders, it's just ridiculous that he's suggesting this.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Joel. Thanks for listening to us on the web there from the UK, and thanks for setting it straight on the statistics from England. Much appreciate your call. Thank you. Josh in Bellingham, Washington, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. So I've been listening to you for about 2 years now. I think this will be, and I've read your book, Screwed, by the way, and I think this is one subject that you and I seem to part ways. Anyway, I called my uncle yesterday when you mentioned this issue about the PTSD and firearms. He works for the VA in Washington, D.C., a psychologist, and he works with a lot of people with PTSD, of course. And I asked his opinion, and his opinion was basically this. A, we should not be infringing on the person's Second Amendment right because it seems to be a slippery slope where you can just diagnose someone and then start taking their rights away. And B, there are some of these people who are diagnosed with PTSD who actually feel as though carrying their firearm is kind of a pacifier in a way, where it actually kind of reduces their shakes. And they don't necessarily use it, it just kind of just sits there and just is a comfort to them, just to have it.
Josh, I think that you are buying into the propaganda that the gun owners folks have been putting out that anybody diagnosed with PTSD no longer is eligible to buy a gun. That is not the case. If you are diagnosed with PTSD, you can still buy a gun and you can still get a concealed weapons permit. You have to be involuntarily committed because you are a threat to yourself or others.
Sure, I'm not arguing with that. I'm just saying just on a broad scale, there are, you know, those who just, you know, it just feels comfortable to them.
So who should not have a gun, Josh?
Who should not have a gun? Well,
who should not be allowed by our society to have a gun?
Well, I personally think people who are criminals or people who are mentally unstable should not have a gun. But
that's what this law says.
Yeah, sure. I understand that. Now, what I'm saying, though, is that those people who are mentally unstable or criminals, that they legally cannot have a gun, but that does not mean that they cannot access guns from some other unlawful person.
But as our ex-police officer called earlier, I mean, just because you have the problem doesn't mean that you say, oh, well, let's throw up our hands and just walk away from it. We've got a problem of too many guns floating around. Let's start pulling them in. Let's do something about that. At the same time, I don't want to stop people from being able to go out on the shooting range like I do with my brother every time I go back to Michigan and, you know, pop a few caps off there. Ted in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, Ted.
Hi, I wanted to comment about the Second Amendment and the people that always seem to talk about gun rights as being where you draw the line in the Second Amendment, and it's arms, the right to bear arms, right? I mean, knives, bow and arrows, crossbows,
Oh, that's interesting. Does that include shoulder-fired rocket launchers?
That's what I'm thinking. My neighbor, I think, has a problem with unidentified helicopters flying over his fields.
Yeah.
What do you
okay, so,
pipe bombs? What if a guy could build a nuclear weapon in his basement?
Does the Second Amendment protect... Right, you're right. There you go. So, okay. Doc! Okay. Just wake you up there. Higgins, back in the closet, back in the corner, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
With speculation, the whole wide world, which people say is round, they will tear your mind away from contemplation. They will jump on your misfortune when you're down. They're talking, just walking, even hog-eyed peace in a hog-eyed town. I'm burning, still yearning. Someday you'll be glad to have me around.
9 minutes before the hour, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Ryan in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Ryan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Frequent listener. I appreciate the show, and I also appreciate the Carter comments. I must say I disagree with you, however, because...
You disagree! How dare you!
We as human beings...
I missed, huh?
we are terrible at predicting behavior on any measure. And that's largely why we have a number of parole issues and predicting, criminal behavior once they get out of jail. Whether or not they should stay in jail based on...
I disagree, Ryan. There's actually a science to, I think it's called penology, as odd as it sounds, to criminal science. And there are ways that you can rehabilitate people in prison. We just choose, by and large, not to use them. And over half of the people who are in prison in the United States are there because of addictions, is absolutely nuts. It's a medical condition. We've criminalized so many things that our system is so broken and so stretched that it can't actually deal with people as people.
Right. But what I'm saying is we do a bad job of predicting future behaviors. And predicting whether or not somebody will be violent again in the future. We don't do that well at all. And to say that a certain group should not have access to firearms is marginalizing them for really no reason or no scientific.
So you think Charlie Manson should be able to get a permit if he gets out of prison?
See, the thing with that is, I mean, you'd be making a policy on that one person. And
no, my point is that there are some indicators that some people carry around with them that are actually relatively predictive of behavior. People who have committed violent crimes in the past are more likely to commit violent crimes in the future. People who have never committed a violent crime are less likely to commit violent crimes.
It's actually largely untrue. There are very few predictors. David Faustin, University of Rhode Island, does a lot of research. So does Robin Dawes at Carnegie Mellon.
There are very few predictors for people who have never offended.
Yeah.
I'll agree with you on that.
People who have both offended and have not offended. And we tend to gravitate towards the sensational, like Charlie Manson, or sensational events throughout people's lives, predicting what they may or may not do again, rather than looking at simple base rates.
I am in favor of something rational. I'm not sure exactly what that is. Yeah, I lived in Vermont in a state where you don't even need a permit to carry a concealed weapon, and I think it's the only state in the union where you don't need a permit to carry a concealed weapon, and it probably has one of the lowest gun violent rates in the entire nation. But that probably has more to do with the demographics and population density of Vermont than it does with the fact that anybody can carry a concealed weapon, although the weapons the guns guys say, oh, it's because everybody's armed. I can tell you from having lived there, everybody is not armed. In fact, most people aren't. There's very few concealed weapons, a lot of hunting rifles around, but that's about it. But on the other hand, when I was 19 years old, my best friend Clark Stinson got drafted and went off to fight in Vietnam, came back from boot camp, And because he was able to walk into a gun shop down the street, this was during Christmas vacation, he came over to my house and just, you know, poured his guts out about how depressed he was and what a horrible mm-hmm. thing, and he didn't want to go and he didn't want to kill people. Mm-hmm. And being 19 and dumb, I just kind of listened and didn't, you know, I didn't know what to say. I kind of blew it off. He went to a gun shop down the street the next day, bought a gun, went back to his room, put it in his mouth, and blew the back of his head all over the backside of his wall.
Mm-hmm.
Had that gun not been available, I believe that Clark would still be alive.
Yeah. Certainly, there will be instances in which the policy would save lives. If, you know, there's more restrictive, but it has to be, I mean, when you're making policy, it's affecting everyone. So.
Well, it is, and we have to ask the question, at what point are guns useful, important, and what's the trade-off, you know, to society?
Correct.
And I thank you, Ryan, for the call. One of my three brothers is a gun collector, and he and his significant other have several guns between the two of them. And I go to Michigan, and one of my favorite things to do is we go down to the shooting range and take everything from 22 target pistols to 45s, which will, you know, knock your hand back into your face if you don't watch it, and do target practice. I love it. It's great fun. It's, you know, toys for boys. But that's on a rifle range and a shooting range, and it's, you know, with proper protection. I mean, it's a completely different thing from just, here, have a gun. Good luck. Vincent in Detroit. Hey, Vincent. Speaking of Michigan.
Hi. I was just calling to agree with gun control. A lot of the proponents that I've spoken with, they seem to come down to one argument, and that is, if everybody has a gun, then criminals will be afraid to commit the crimes. And a lot of the,
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We are running out of time, though, so if you can get to your point quickly.
Okay. And a lot of the people who commit the really heinous crimes, they usually commit suicide afterwards. So it seems to me that have a victim having a gun against a person who really intends on doing something very heinous isn't really an effective deterrent if he plans on killing himself after.
The BBC did a study a couple of years ago, and they found what you're talking about is suicide. Basically, it's either suicide by cop or it's suicide taking a bunch of people with you. And there are some interesting studies on the relationship between, or some interesting speculation on the relationship between psychiatric drugs and that. That's relatively a whole different area. But if you look at the statistics that the BBC pulled together over an 80-year period in England, they found that when conservative governments had power, suicide rates went up. And when they didn't, suicide rates went down. It's about
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back to the program. 6 minutes past the hour. I want to put a caveat out here before I get into this topic about Hillary Clinton. This has to do with a posting by Rad Eyes over at the Democratic Underground forums, democraticunderground.com. And the caveat is that, and I don't think I've made any secret of this, and so, but it bears repeating, that Hillary Clinton is not my favorite candidate for president. That said, if she's the nominee of the party, I would support her and I would vote for her. I think, frankly, any Democrat is better than any Republican right now, particularly given the field that we have on both sides. And Hillary has a lot to commend her. She's got some fairly progressive positions. She has, however, a lot of areas where I am in strong disagreement with her, as do many of the other candidates. But I think I'm probably most philosophically aligned with Dennis Kucinich, and, you know, just as point of disclosure, these are public records anyway, anybody can find it out. The one Democratic candidate that I've actually contributed money to on, I think, four or five different occasions now, is John Edwards. which is not an endorsement. I'm not endorsing anybody. I'm just telling you, you know, where I'm at. I think any of the Democratic candidates are good. But here's the question that's being asked by a lot of progressives and activists, the base, in the Democratic Party, and that Rad Eyes over at Democratic Underground raises the question. First of all, it says, okay, now the explanation behind the polls. Why is it that on, for example, our poll here in Portland, 620kpoj.com, we're finding that Edwards and Kucinich are way out in front of any of the other contenders, including Hillary Clinton? Why is it that in many of the straw polls all around the country, you find that Hillary Clinton is way down low, and yet in the national polls, she's up high? Frankly, I think that it has to do with name recognition, that the media can't go 15 minutes without saying Hillary Clinton. Whereas you can go days without hearing John Edwards' name or Dennis Kucinich's name, or for that matter, Chris Dodd or Mike Gravel or Joe Biden's name mentioned, or Barack Obama's name mentioned on the radio or television, although it tends to be mostly Hillary and Barack. And I think, frankly, from the Republicans' point of view, the candidate that they would least like to run against is the most progressive, and that's at least of the major three, and that's John Edwards, because they're looking at what happened with Brian Schweitzer in Montana, and they're the governor who's arguably the most progressive governor in the United States, winning hugely in a red state simply by standing up and telling the truth, or Bernie Sanders, who in parts of the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont carries areas that go 70-80% to Bush every single election and to the Republicans, carries those same areas by 70-80%. And yet he's so progressive, he's not even a Democrat. So I'm convinced that the politician who actually has the greatest ability to easily and handily beat any Republican is John Edwards, but Hillary Clinton is the one that the media has apparently chosen for whatever reason. And so the question is, that being the case, and again, with my caveat that I and this show am not about taking down Hillary, but this is a discussion that is being actively participated with in a variety of forums around the web and other is what do you do? Rad Eyes is suggesting that the reason that Hillary has the support she does is that she has an unwavering base of about a third of the party, which means about two-thirds of the party is opposed to her. The problem is that there's all these candidates. It's like, you know, having a third-party candidate split a ticket. And, in fact, in one of the recent Democratic Underground polls, over 70% of the respondents said that they'd be willing to switch their vote to Edwards if it meant defeating Clinton. Red Eyes notes, believing that of all the candidates, Clinton is the most polarizing, and it is not in our own party or in the nation's interest. It is in our party or the nation's interest important to choose someone else. Again, that person's opinion, not mine. So they propose three possible scenarios. Number one, after Iowa and New Hampshire, if Clinton is indeed the front runner, those who would rather not nominate Clinton agree to coalesce behind whoever is in the second place, period. And just say, okay, everybody's going to get behind the second place candidate. Option number one. I don't think it's going to happen. Option number two, after Iowa and New Hampshire, we Democrats put heavy pressure on all but the top two candidates to drop out of the race, which is kind of a variation on number one. Except asking actually everybody else, just saying, please drop out of the race. Make this a two-person race. Or not, because we have first-past-the-poll, winner-take-all elections. Or number three, and this is the one that I think is the most viable and actually makes the most sense and is the most small-d democratic, we ask a pledge from all the candidates now that every single one of them will promise to remain in the race all the way through the primaries and caucuses, leaving no candidate with enough delegates at the convention with a majority, setting up a situation where it will take several ballots for the convention to choose a nominee, perhaps a dark horse candidate that everyone likes. And then this poster over at Democratic Underground says, oh, and by the way, if Gore gets in the race, all bets are off. I'm voting for Gore. And I think that there's a broad sentiment for that, but I don't think Al Gore is going to get into the race. Although we'll see. If he wins the Nobel Prize on Friday, who knows? So, you know, what's the best way to handle this? Or is it something that even needs to be handled? Is there a democratic process with the primaries or not? And this is a conversation I had with David Sirota yesterday or the day before, where I am suggesting that we shouldn't have primary voting at all. What we should have is those people who are committed enough to the Democratic and Republican parties, and the Green Party for that matter, and the Libertarian Party, whatever it may be, those people who are sufficiently committed to a party to volunteer and show up for the monthly meetings should be the ones who sit in the room and decide who the nominee of that state is going to be. And so if you want to participate, then that participation earns you a disproportionate voice. Or a significant voice, let's say. And if somebody doesn't want to participate, they've surrendered their voice. This is the way it used to be done. This is the way it was done for over 100 years. I think that's the way it should be done. But, you know, we're not going to change that before the primaries. That ain't going to happen. So, how do we handle that? Interesting question. So, we've got a whole variety of things on the table. Guns, impeachment. Today is the anniversary of the vote in the Senate to authorize George W. Bush, if he certifies in writing to the Senate and the House of Representatives that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11, and he did, then he may use military force against Saddam. Today is the anniversary of that vote. What are you going to do with all of this stuff? 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Dan in Belfair, Washington. Hey, Dan.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Love your show, and your books are fantastic.
Thank you.
I think I would propose option 4 of those options that you identified. And
draft Gore?
Yes.
I see. Okay. And I'm not going to disagree with that, Dan. Brian, and thank you for the call. Brian in Napa, California. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. Appreciate it. You know, I think what the answer for primaries is open primaries. And I don't know.
Well, the problem with open primaries is you get a lot of mischief. You get people, you know, that means that I can vote in the Republican primary and I can vote for the guy that I think is going to be the weakest candidate. And there's actually parties in states that have open primaries have massively organized people to do just exactly that. And it's a disaster. James, I'm moving through these calls pretty fast here. We don't have a lot of time in this hour. James in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, James.
Good morning.
Hey.
I was wondering about the future of George Bush's signing statements. What will happen when he leaves office? Will they be unsigned? Would he want a Democrat to be able to have the ones that he currently has?
Well, that's a good question. There are a lot of scholars who suggest that the signing statements that he's done so far are illegal. It's probably going to have to go to the Supreme Court, barring legislation, and you know we haven't seen the legislation yet. On the other hand, there may be somebody running for president on the Democratic side who thinks that he or she is going to be elected president who would like to have the power to have signing statements, you know, and maybe that's what's restraining the Democrats from going against them. I honestly don't know, but I think that it's a crime against our democracy. And let's keep in mind, the guy who came up with the concept of signing statements back during the Reagan presidency was one of Reagan's lawyers, a guy by the name of Sam Alito, who is now on the Supreme Court. 16 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, TomHartmann.com. You want to drop into our live chat room. Also, we've got a poll up to help us redesign our website there.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartmann Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Greg in Orange County, California. You're on the air, Greg. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I have a comment actually about John Edwards. You had you mentioned that he, you know, you've kind of given him some positive support, but you're not endorsing him. I saw him on PBS the other night. I only caught part of the program, but he by far, I think, has the most pragmatic viewpoints on things. Like, as much as I would like to see a Dennis Kucinich America, I think that he probably is the most realistic in terms of viewing things.
Let me say that the reason that I'm not endorsing John Edwards is because I just don't think it's appropriate for me to endorse any of the Democratic candidates before the election. Because, as I said, any Democrat is better than any Republican, and this is a critical time for a Democrat to be president with the Supreme Court in the balance. And so I'll tell you honestly, you know, how I feel, where I stand, and even where I put my money, but I don't want any candidate to claim my endorsement.
Yeah, no, I understand, but I'll tell you from a practical and pragmatic perspective, I mean, again, as much as it would be nice to have somebody like Dennis Kucinich running the show, I think a lot of his stuff is really kind of petting the cat backwards, if you know what I'm saying. I think that John Edwards.
Well, I don't want to pick on Dennis. I know Dennis, and you know, he's a friend and he's a good guy, and we've shared the platform on a number of occasions, you know, speaking together in various venues, and I think very, very highly of Dennis Kucinich, and have for many years. That said, I believe that John Edwards would make a better president of the United States, and that's just my opinion. And I know that all the Kucinich supporters are now going to email me, give me the 16 reasons. Here's the John Edwards supports the death penalty, and you don't, and that's true. You can call it an irrational decision, you can call it a gut feeling, you can call it whatever you want. I don't feel the need to absolutely justify it. That's just where I'm standing. So,
right.
Greg, I got to move along, but thank you for your call and your comment, Marty in L.A. Hey, Marty.
Yeah, I echo the last caller's statements, and what I wanted to say also is I think I mentioned to you a few months ago that unfortunately Hillary Clinton is a uniter of the Republican Party, and no matter how much disarray they're in, they will rally to beat her. The other thing
I believe this is why both the Republican Party, this is why you had both Giuliani and
Romney.
Romney, yeah, I was trying to remember which one it was. Yeah, Romney, mentioning her during the Republican debates night before last, and this is why, as Chris Matthews, who has been a fairly obvious Giuliani partisan for well over a year now, they're all trying to get Hillary in there because it's going to be having Hillary run for office will be the very best thing that could happen for the Republican Party.
Where the pragmatic
on the other hand, having a woman as a president would be a marvelous thing, and Hillary might make a marvelous president. It's possible she could be our next FDR. I mean, I don't know.
Well, you know, where the pragmatic comes into play, Tom, you mentioned, Montana with Governor Schweitzer. You know, look at all the states that would open up to a possibility for Edwards that traditionally have been Republican. You're talking like Arizona, Colorado, Montana, Nevada, North Carolina, West Virginia, that Hillary Clinton would have no chance. And you can't see Hillary Clinton going into Montana with Schweitzer and John Tester. It's not going to be welcome there. And we have to deal with the pragmatic here. And all these people that Hillary is benefiting from this perception of inevitability created by the media. And I wish we could get rid of that.
Yeah, well, good luck. Good luck, Marty. Thanks for the call. Mike in Burien, Washington. Hey, Mike.
Oh, it dovetails great, Tom, because what I was going to say was the fact that if we all remember, a little while back, it was Hillary who made the deal with the devil. Rupert Murdoch, what was that meeting all about in the media, okay? So the spin had started back then about what a great leader she would make. And also,
she may make a great leader. I mean, again, let's not write her off. I'm not here to try and trash her. I'm just raising the question.
No, that's not the issue. What I wanted to say, too, is for people to read, and I don't mean just read today. Go back 5, 10, 15 years when Hillary Clinton was a young Republican, and she still to this day has been in a prayer group with all those crazy conservatives, Christian conservatives in the Capitol.
Well, yes, and when I was 13 years old, 1964, Hillary's a little older than I am, I went door to door for Barry Goldwater with my dad, who was a county official with the Republican Party. I read his book. I still, frankly, have a lot of respect for Barry Goldwater, and I've been a member of a prayer group for years.
No,
I don't think that disqualifies her.
No. But people need to know. And they also, the Clintons were the ones that were first to start the faith-based initiatives, which I am abhorrently against. There's no bigger issue with me than the separation of church and state, and those
I
two
agree.
Brought it on.
Although they didn't put it on steroids the way George W. Bush did.
He blew it up.
Yeah, and they didn't, frankly, perhaps you could say that they exploited it in a small way for political purposes.
Yeah, how wonderfully that worked. The Clintons, it's really backfired on the Democrats. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. And Mike, I think that the Democrats have figured that out. I have a feeling that the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives is going to go away when the next president comes in, assuming that the next president is a Democrat. The Republicans are going to see the reason that the Republicans have to reach out to conservative Christians is with so-called family issues like being anti-gay, homophobia, and in the South, racism, is because their real agenda is economic, and it's the destruction of the middle class, and they can't talk about that. So if they can't talk about that, they got to figure out what else to talk about. And scaring people and appealing to people's basest instincts into hatred is pretty much all they have, tragically. And so it's what they do. And, and of course now it's be afraid of the terrorists. Yeah, right. Come on. We are not afraid. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself and those who would want us to fear. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Coming to you every hour on the hour. The weather's fine, but there may be a meteor shower.
It's our best of the rest of the news segment, where every week we go out to the tubes, not the trucks. The internets, and find a couple of some of the best websites out there, and find out what people are talking about on the internet. What are the big news stories? What are the things that are sliding by under the radar? Aaron Glantz is with us. His website, aaronglantz.com, and warcomehome.org. He's the author of How America Lost Iraq, and runs the warcomehome.org website. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Oh, my pleasure.
And Todd Tucker is with us. He's the research director for Public Citizens Global Trade Watch Division. EyesOnTrade.org is the website. Todd, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. Todd, let me start with you. I noticed Barack Obama, according to an article at least that David Sirota wrote, pulling an article off MSNBC, Obama said he would vote for a Peruvian trade agreement next week in response to a question from a man in Londonderry, New Hampshire, who called CAFTA a NAFTA disaster. He said he supported the trade agreement with Peru because it contained the labor and environmental standards sought by groups like the AFL-CIO, despite the voters' protest to the contrary. He also affirmed his support for free trade. What's going on?
Well, it's interesting that Obama is trying to use labor as political cover for this, because actually no labor union in the U.S. Is supporting the Peru trade deal, which will expand NAFTA to Peru. It's also interesting because Obama opposed a virtually identical agreement with Central America in 2005, and no Democratic group supported that either, and recent polls are showing that the trade issue is going to be a major one in the general as well, since Republicans and swing voters are also turning against status quo trade policy.
So is Obama shooting himself in the foot here?
It seems like not only a bad policy judgment, but a pretty bad political judgment as well.
Yeah, interesting. One of you guys has got a whole lot of noise in the background, if you could hold it down. So, Todd, what over at EyesOnTrade.org, real quickly, what do you see as the top stories there on your website?
Well, I think in addition to the Obama story, there's also just rising opposition to this Peru trade deal. Just this week, to give an example, groups from Peru are in Washington denouncing their government for aiding and abetting the sell-off of the Peruvian Amazon to big oil companies. This is connected to the trade deal because there's provisions in this deal that will give incentives for further deforestation of the Amazon, which in turn will affect global warming and reduce energy independence. So, and big oil companies in 2004, when the trade deal was first being negotiated by Bush, had about 15% of the Peruvian Amazon. Now that's about up to 60% today. So they are well aware of the incentives in this trade deal for further deforestation and drilling, and that's yet another reason why the Obama decision seems pretty stupid.
Yeah, interesting. Aaron Glantz over at warcomeshome.org. Hey, Aaron, what are you seeing as the top of the news on your website?
Well, one of the stories that we decided to highlight on warcomeshome.org is the story of Gerald Cassidy, who's a National Guard vet from the Indiana National Guard who made it out of Iraq after getting hit by a roadside bomb and then died on a U.S. military base at Fort Knox 5 months later. And it really raises the question, we get this number, 3,818 U.S. soldiers died in Iraq. How many of them are dying after they come home? And
in particular,
as a consequence of what happened while they were in Iraq.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, we had this GAO report that came out recently that we talked about the last time I was on the show that showed half of the military hospitals in this country are short-staffed by 50% or more in terms of their doctors and nurses. You have a case like this guy, Gerald, who passed on a U.S. military base where he was supposed to be getting care at Fort Knox, and nobody even found him, according to the autopsy report, until he had been unconscious for days.
Yeah, and so what's the solution?
Well, I mean, the solution, first of all, is the Bush administration and Congress have to pony up some money to hire some doctors and nurses. The Walter Reed scandal hit a few months ago, and they said, oh, well, we're going to have all these centers of excellence for wounded warriors around the country. Well, it doesn't do any good to call Fort Knox a center of excellence if you don't hire any doctors or nurses to staff it. And so I think that's a big thing. The other story that I wanted to highlight for your listeners that we have up on warcomeshome.org has to do with the case of Lieutenant Aaron Watada, who was the first U.S. officer, commissioned officer, to refuse a deployment to Iraq on the grounds that he thought the war was immoral and illegal. I was at his court-martial back in February where they had a mistrial, and the military was trying to bring him up on charges again this past week, and a federal judge intervened and agreed with Lieutenant Watada that that would be double jeopardy, that according to our Constitution, you can't put somebody on trial twice for the same crime. And, of course, the reason that the military wants to get Lieutenant Watada is because over 10,000 U.S. soldiers have deserted since the war began 4 years ago, and they want to keep somebody who's a well-spoken lieutenant like himself from getting away with avoiding a deployment to Iraq.
They want to do it the same reason that the Burmese generals are massacring monks. They want to basically terrorize everybody else into not behaving the same way.
Yeah, he's very dangerous because, you know, a lot of vets are coming back screwed up with post-traumatic stress disorder and deserting or going AWOL to avoid a second deployment, but they're not necessarily as well-spoken as a university-educated lieutenant who can explain in very calm, measured tones why he thinks the war is wrong.
Right. Not just wrong. Illegal. Good
and
point.
And immoral, according to him.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Todd Tucker over at eyesontrade.org. Todd, what are the stories that you see, you know, bubbling along that we're really not making the top of the radar screen, but that either we should be paying more attention to or we will be paying more attention to as time goes on?
Well, the Republicans are engaging again in voter fraud, and this time it's not in Florida or Ohio, but it's in Costa Rica.
It's actually election fraud, isn't it, rather than voter fraud?
Exactly, right, right. Last Sunday in Costa Rica, they held the first ever public referendum on a NAFTA expansion, the CAFTA deal, and the yes vote narrowly won. But the fair trade groups in Costa Rica are crying foul. Just hours before the polls opened, Bush's press secretary, Dana Perino, threatened Costa Ricans with economic reprisals if the country rejected CAFTA. But this is in the middle of a media blackout on discussions of CAFTA in Costa Rica, so the no vote didn't have a chance to respond or debunk the false threats that the Bush administration was launching. So of course this was well known ahead of the announcement that it would be covered by all the right wing press in the country, that the right wing president would talk about it. So this was on the headlines of every newspaper the day that Costa Ricans are going to vote in this historic referendum on a trade deal. So,
gee, just like the Bin Laden tapes surfacing a week before the national 2004 elections.
That's absolutely right. And so the groups down there are calling for investigation into this, as are members of Congress, and asking, you know, not only why is the Bush administration treating Central America like its backyard, but if it's so confident of the merits of these so-called free trade deals, why don't they just let the voters decide?
Right. Why lobby it so hard? And just enormous amounts of money were spent on this, not to mention the power, prestige, and money of the U.S. government to promote this. Aaron Glantz over at warcomeshome.org. Aaron, what are you seeing at warcomeshome.org as the stories that either aren't getting enough attention or are the things bubbling below the surface that are about to blow up?
Well, you know, one thing that I'm watching very closely is to see if Congress passes this package of bills, which is called the Wounded Warrior legislation, before they go home this year. You know, we were mentioning earlier this National Guardsman dying
you know, on Fort Knox after returning wounded from Iraq and in the sorry state of medical care for soldiers in this country. And, you know, Congress has been saying that they're going to do something about this, and yet they haven't. And a lot of people are watching to see, you know, they're going to go away pretty soon. Are they actually going to do something, or are they just going to beat their chest and appear before the cameras and, you know, figure that that's going to be enough?
And what's your guess on how it's going to play out?
Well, people are very I'd say it's 50-50. You know, it just is a matter of them having the energy to go do it. It's really been interesting for me, somebody watching this, you know, used to covering more controversial things than caring for veterans after they come back, which everyone kind of agrees is a good idea. But here you have a situation where, you know, both political parties agree that this is a good idea, and yet somehow they manage to argue about it. You know, it happens.
Well, it's going to involve money.
Yeah, absolutely. It is about money, but a lot of it is also about turf, about credit, and about the fact that these guys are too busy campaigning for president to actually push the things they believe in.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. Yeah, very interesting. So we'll see. Yeah, is there a Senate filibuster involved in that?
No, I think it's just, you know, it's very hard to bring something like that to the surface. As you know, there's so many... It takes so many steps to get anything brought to the surface in the Senate, but I think a lot of it is, you know, you have somebody like Barack Obama. He has a bill to help veterans. Hillary Clinton has a bill to help veterans. But are they spending their energy shepherding these bills to the Congress, or are they going to, you know, thousands of dollar a plate fundraisers?
Yeah, well, I mean, they're running for president. I don't think that you can specifically fault them for that. There's certainly a lot of other senators who can take good legislation and run with it. But good point, and it'll be interesting to watch. Aaron Glantz, warcomeshome.org. He's the author also of How America Lost Iraq, and runs the warcomeshome.org website. And Todd Tucker, the research director for the Senate, the Public Citizens Global Trade Watch Division, eyesontrade.org, the website. Aaron, Todd, thank you, gentlemen, both for being with us today.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Good talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, Talk Radio News, Washington, D.C., coming up next.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
As we celebrate mediocrity, all the boys upstairs wanna see how much you'll pay for what you used to get for free. And there goes the last DJ who plays what he wants to play and says what he wants to say.
Right here, saying what we want to say. By the way, right now it's time for this afternoon's Progressive Pop Quiz. Our question for today. Today is the anniversary of the Senate passing what piece of legislation? 5 years ago. The fifth caller with the correct answer at 866-303-2270 receives a free copy of my latest book, Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision, just now coming out. In fact, you can get it before it's available in stores, although it is available online. Again, the question. Today is the anniversary of the Senate passing what piece of legislation 5 years ago? The answer toward the end here of our conversation with Ellen Ratner from Talk Radio News and the Progressive Pop Quiz and the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, what's going on in Washington, D.C. today?
We're sort of a lot of news happening between both the United Nations and Washington, D.C., and they're related, and that is that...
Ellen, are you on a speakerphone?
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay.
But,
it's just a funky connection.
Okay. We're at a board, actually, so maybe our board is terrible.
Yeah.
I can try and pick up a phone. Let me see.
Yeah.
Does that sound better?
No, it sounds about the same. But that's okay. Just keep going.
All right. We'll keep going. We'll try and fix our board here. We're actually at a studio. Anyway, but essentially what has happened is that the United Nations has the reporters at the United Nations asked today about the fact that there are three Israeli ships outside of Lebanon United Nations says that they cannot confirm that. And, of course, the White House is not being very knowledgeable about that as well, even though with today's satellite, I don't think it's terribly difficult.
Interesting. You know, my guess, by the way, is that what's going on there, if you're running this through a board, is that you've got more than one mic open, and I'm hearing the echo off the second
mic.
Yeah,
well, we tried to close all our mics, too.
So are you suggesting that Olmert may be preparing to attack Hezbollah in Lebanon, and that's what's up, or is this something, you know, some part of cooperative preparation with the United States for an attack in Iran, or what?
I would say that it has something to do with going on in southern Lebanon, given particularly that the Harari was at the United Nations the other day. He knows what's going on, and people just aren't saying.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting.
A couple other quick things, even though I'm on a terrible phone line.
Sure.
And that is that it's interesting. Yesterday we talked about Turkey condemning the House and genocide resolution and what's up with that. First of all, Turkey pulled their ambassador back from Washington for 10 days. But interestingly enough, Bush called it genocide when he was running for president, is not calling it that way. Dick Gephardt wanted to completely and totally try and support this resolution when he was minority leader, and now he was hired by the Turks to try and get the Congress not to pass this resolution.
To lobby against it.
That's right.
Yeah. So what's going to be the fate of it? Or what?
Well, it
passed, didn't it?
It passed the committee. It has not passed the whole, and my guess is it will not come up for the whole.
I see. So probably Nancy Pelosi or the committee. Is it that the committee is not going to report it out, or Pelosi is not going to bring it to the floor for a vote?
It'll be Pelosi not bringing it up to the floor for a vote.
Interesting. And what else going on in Washington, D.C.?
Okay, well, it's interesting. The Afghan government also has moved against private security firms, and they actually dumped two firms this week. They're trying to dump 10 others this week, and people have not been talking very much about the fact that the Marines basically want to pull more people out of Iraq and want to take much more of a lead in terms of what is happening in Afghanistan. And that is another one. And last but not least, although I could go on, the Democrats are seeming to cave. Some of the Blue Dog Democrats are looking for a compromise on the FISA immunity issue. They want to maybe have a statute of limitations for what AT&T and some of these other companies did by cooperating with the government. Not good.
Hmm. At the same time that we're discovering this was reported, I saw it over at thinkprogress.org. I'm not sure where it was originally reported, that Qwest Communications, which is the only major telecom that refused to go along with the Bush administration and let them spy on their listeners, Qwest was actually punished for that by the Bush administration at the time, according to testimony from their president in a lawsuit.
Well, yeah, but remember that closet of AT&T? And in San Francisco, apparently, they're under, as the White House said yesterday, huge lawsuits, monetary lawsuits. We can't let them lose any money.
Yeah. Well,
that
and
really
that's ultimately,
terrible.
I mean, you know, for the Republicans, that's ultimately what it's all about, is we can't let our potential campaign contributors and our past campaign contributors lose any money. And couldn't have that. Well, plus, you know, a conviction, frankly.
But you've got Blue Dog Democrats saying, let's make a compromise in terms of limiting the statute of limitations. What's that about?
Well, they're probably getting the same campaign contributions from the same big telcos.
Exactly.
So, I mean, would be my guess. I mean, you know, the Republican light wing of the Democratic Party tends to be the let's go where the money is wing. And so, anyhow, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thanks so much for the report today.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. And we have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. It's Kim Loftness in Shoreline, Washington. And Kim is going to get, she knew, by the way, that today is the anniversary of the Senate vote on the Iraq War Resolution. And Kim is going to get a copy of my new book, Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision, in the mail. Thank you, Kim. In fact, a signed and autographed copy. Coming up tomorrow, Anything Goes Friday. Call in and talk about anything and everything. Senator Bernie Sanders in our first hour, Brunch with Bernie, will be taking your calls on anything and everything, as he does every Friday at noon. Plus, David Cobb is going to drop by, former Green Party presidential candidate, and as always, the best of the rest of the news and your calls. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.